Good morning. Today is Wednesday, September 5th, and you are listening to The Morning Show here on 88.5 KRFY. This is community radio, by the way, and thanks for joining us today for the second part of a special four-week Wednesday morning show presentation of Water is Life. This series will be available also at krfy.org as a podcast after it airs. And I'm Susie Prez.
And I'm Jean Girth, and we'll be your hosts for this series, Water is Life. Last week, in part one, we explored water, what it is, why it is essential for life, where it comes from, how it is tested and regulated as the source for our drinking water, and water resources here at home in North Idaho, as well as around the world.
In each weekly segment, we present facts and statistics based on science and recognized analysis. Today, the second week in this four-part series is focused on how did Lake Pend'Oreille and its associated waters get here? A historic tale told by glacial Lake Missoula and the big flood experts, Tony Lewis and Dean Garwood from the Ice Age Flood Institute.
In our second interview, we talk about the water cycle and how it impacts water supply in the inland Northwest and the globe. And we'll be talking with Robin Fox, weather forecaster from the National Weather Service in Spokane.
Before we get to the interviews, Jean, did you know, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, Bonner County has a total area of 1,919 square miles, of which 1,725 square miles is land, and 185 square miles is water, or 9.6%.
And Susie, did you know that Lake Pend'Oreille is the 38th in the U.S. in surface area? It's the 8th largest in the U.S. by volume, and it's the 5th deepest lake in the U.S., right after the Great Lakes.
And some of this information will be discussed in our upcoming interviews, which were recorded earlier. But this first interview, like we said, is with the Ice Age Institute guys, Tony Lewis and Dean Garwood. They came in earlier this week and spoke to us. Very interesting. It's riveting, actually.
It is riveting. And I want to get them back and maybe even do a whole series on the Ice Age floods. It is an astounding story, and it's all local. And you can go see evidence of the floods. They'll talk about that. And the impact, what happened after that flood.
Well, we're ready. We can get to this first interview. We'll be back right after the interview live. But this is Dr. Tony Lewis and geologist Dean Garwood from the Ice Age Flood Institute. Thank you, Dr. Tony Lewis and Dean Garwood, for joining the discussion on this series, Water is Life. In this segment, we want to take a look at how this big, beautiful lake and surrounding geographic landscape came about many years ago, 15,000 years ago, actually. And I was told that you are the guys to talk to about this. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Lewis, let's start with you. You have spent a majority of your professional life studying and developing radar imaging to map out and decipher the geographic landscape around the world. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and why you became interested in the Ice Age phenomenon known as glacial Lake Missoula and the Big Flood?
Okay, well, thank you. I'm a retired college professor. I taught at Louisiana State University for 30 years, and I taught in the geography department. My academic training was mainly in the analysis of landforms or geomorphology. So when we moved here, my daughter Sharon Lewis, who lives here, she introduced me to the Ice Age Flood Institute and the phenomena that is the Ice Age floods. So how could I not be interested? And the topic is, I found out, is much more interesting and much more complex than I ever thought. But being in the place where the ice dam blocked the Clark Fork River, forming Glacial Lake Missoula, and the subsequent gigantic floods that followed when these ice dams collapsed is really special for me. These floods are a remarkable part of North American natural heritage, and they've had profound effects on the geography, way of life in this region, but still remain largely unknown to the general public.
It really sparked your interest.
Yes, it did.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Dean Garwood. You're a geologist. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what also sparked your interest in this phenomena.
Most of my interest came from growing up in the area. I grew up in Hayden, but spent most of my summers around Trestle Creek. And, the land that you live on, it's interesting. So when I went to college, I started learning about geology. And the more you learn, the more you want to know about your landscape and places you travel and what made mountains, what made these flat areas, you know. And so just having grown up here, and I worked for the state of Idaho for many years under a guy named Roy Breckenridge, a colleague of ours that passed last year. And really the credit for all the work in North Idaho should really go to Roy Breckenridge. And he got me interested in the floods. My background was in volcanic rocks and geologic mapping. So Roy sparked my interest in the Ice Age Floods Institute, and just keep learning more ever since.
Well, thank you. You both have mentioned the word floods. I thought it was one flood, but it sounds like it's a whole big picture. So we want to get a sense of the geographic majesty and mystery of how this area and large lake, Lake Pend'Oreille, came to be. And you can decide who talks about it, but tell us about the big flood and Ice Age glacial Lake Missoula.
Okay, well, actually, this the landscape that surrounds us began to form over 2 billion years ago with the formation of these fine-grained rocks called argillites that we see poking out along the road cuts on Highway 200 going to Hope. Now, if we skip forward 1,999,000,000 years, we get to the Ice Age, which was about 1 million years ago. And if we skip forward again, the Ice Age, or the ice formation that we're concerned with, was at the last glaciation, and that was ending about 12 to 13,000 years ago. But what happened was, this is continental glaciation, which means that the glacier was covering continents in size. It was large mass of ice that moved down from Canada, and about 2,000, 3,000 feet thick, it moved down what's called the Purcell Trench, which is the area between the Cabinet Mountains and the Selkirk Mountains. And it moved down over Bonner's Ferry, and it moved down over Sandpoint and pushed further south until it hit the Monarchs. And when it hit the Monarchs, it kind of split into different lobes, or they call sublobes. One of these sublobes went up the Clark Fork River and blocked the Clark Fork, later forming Glacial Lake Missoula. Another one went south and went through this valley that had been formed before and carved it down another 2,500 feet and went all the way further down past Farragut State Park. As it retreated back up, and it did this several times, some people think over 50 times, to back up, that it also deposited material and left about 1,500 feet of deposited material in what we know now as Lake Pend'Oreille, making this lake over 1,000 feet deep in some places, and making it the largest and deepest lake in Idaho. This lake is obviously the focus point of Sandpoint, and it is fed by the Clark Fork River and by the Pack Rivers, and drains through the Pend'Oreille River and out the Spokane Rathdrum Aquifer.
I know that this is another big story, but if it's so interesting, if you could touch briefly on how this historic event was discovered. And I'm thinking about, was it Brett's and the skepticism that he was met with and how he convinced people?
Yeah, so back in the early 20s, a guy named J. Harlan Brett's started mapping across Washington and finding all these very large landforms formed by water, but it's out in the middle of what now is basically a desert. And he started mapping out all these structures and these big channels and giant current dunes, but really didn't have a source for his water. About the same time, a guy named J.T. Pardee was doing his work over in Montana, and he had recognized this large glacial lake in the area. There are strand lines or old shorelines you can see up above, like the town of Missoula. You see these lines on the hill. Those are the old shorelines from that lake. Unfortunately, at that time, the two of them didn't cross their ideas or didn't dawn on them that this was a big deal. So Brett's had this idea of these massive floods, but he didn't have a source for his water, where this came from. And eventually they finally got together and realized, wow, this is the lake. And Pardee had recognized some of these giant current features on the bottom of the lake floor, and those formed when the lake drained catastrophically like that. So that was kind of how the floods got started. In this area, again, it was the Idaho Geological Survey back in the 90s started doing geologic mapping in North Idaho. And Roy spent about 30 years of his life doing research and mapping out different deposits that came from the glaciers or from the outwash coming off the glaciers or glacial lakes that they had formed. And so Roy was a surficial geologist. He's looking at the younger kinds of materials. And so then now we have this very detailed kind of geology. We can start talking about the story in more detail and looking at other things that we can learn more detail, specifically on dates and things like that.
So we kind of know how it was discovered. These two scientists came together, or geologists and scientists came together and brought it into a picture. Is there any way you can describe, because I think it's such a phenomena, what happened, what it really looked like before the floods, what that dam looked like, how big was it? You said that the lake that was formed is called Lake Missoula, was all the way into Missoula. That's 200 miles from the headwaters of the Clark, or from Lake Pend'Oreille as we know it now. Can you give us a description of what that must have been like back then? That's 15,000 years ago.
Well, right here in Sandpoint, we would have been under about 2,400 feet of ice. So when that Purcell Trench lobe came down, again, continental glaciation, you know, the north and south poles are colder climates than we had more of this going on. And so we would have had a tremendous amount of ice. Things like Schweitzer would have just been sticking out above the surface of that. And so we have been able to see this in, the lake is something that's just left from that. We wouldn't have Lake Pend'Oreille here if it wasn't for those glaciers coming down and carving out that material.
The ice dam that formed from those glacial or the continental glaciers, what did that look like and where was it located?
So it would have come down that Purcell Trench between the Selkirks and the Cabinets, and then when it hit where the lake basin is now, it would have started to spread out, one part of it going over towards the Monarchs and the Clark Fork. And so if you look up at Green Monarch Ridge, the ice would have been most of the way up that ridge and then all the way up the valley. And the lake, actually, Roy had some historical photos that were flown in the 30s. When they had large fires and they actually burned off that whole area, if you look across from Clark Fork up at the mountains, today it's just trees. You can't really see anything, but we have these old photos and you can actually see those strand lines on the hills up there, just like you're in Missoula. And so we know the lake was there, and the lake actually was high enough that it was almost coming over the tops of those mountains to where the ice is now. And so this lake was, several thousand feet deep. It went all the way, filled the Bitterroot Valley, most of the valleys in western Montana. And so that lake has actually been, it's actually size-wise as much water as is in Lake Erie and Lake Ontario combined. So that's the amount of water that would have held.
Yeah, and along with that, there are some flood facts that we always like to talk about when we talk about the floods and this plug and all like that. As we talked about before, the Ice Age floods are really associated with those global scale periods of glaciation. And the number of flood events that we have really varies with the researcher. Roy Breckenridge, who Dean and I really learned from, he was more of the multiple kind of theory that there were 50 and some people say up to 100 of these floods, and that they would occur when this sublobe plugged up the Clark Fork and in its advance, and then when it retreated, it would disintegrate and there would be an explosion of water coming out of the Clark Fork drainage basin. That was they estimate to be 500 cubic miles of water that would be released, and it would take 2 to 3 days for this basin to empty. And with the floodwaters moving at 60, some people say 80 miles per hour in some locations, flowing all the way to the Pacific Ocean, taking approximately 2 weeks to get to the Pacific Ocean, and drastically changing the landscape in its path. So it was a major event or major events. Presently, some people that are studying, Dean knows, that are doing a lot of studying in the Spokane area, their theory is now that there was one major flood and all the rest of them were pretty minor. So it's the research is ongoing.
I love mysteries. This is still unfolding. I know I heard about this flood when I first moved to Sandpoint about 30 years ago, and there's been lots of new facts that I've learned today. There's a lot to talk about. I just want to move us a little into the present now. The impact that these geological formations have on our current water sources, because this series is focused on kind of appreciating what we've got here, the clean water that we've got. So can you tell us, we were talking before we started about aquifers and the flow of water and how connected is all of this?
Okay, so when the ice dam failed, much of the water went down the current channel of Lake Pendray, and then at Bayview Farragut area, that's where we were pretty confined, and so there was a lot of flow there. As that water was flowing out of the Pendray Basin, it was also scouring those sediments out of the lake, because we wouldn't have had a deep lake. It would have been mostly filled with glacial sediments. And then as the dam breaks up and it starts gushing out all this water, well, it starts picking up all that sediment from the bottom of the lake, and then it deposits it downstream. And in that case, that's the Rathdrum Prairie aquifer. And so that big flat prairie out there is several hundred feet of gravels that were deposited by this big flood or floods, depending on which story you're going with. And so that pot of gravels is our Rathdrum Prairie aquifer. It's the only reason that we have Spokane and Coeur d'Alene and all the people here is because of this great source of water we have.
So it was the gravel being pushed by the flood, and that's a huge amount of gravel that is underneath probably some topsoil now, that is holding, it's a basin basically holding water. And you mentioned Spirit Lake and other lakes in that area.
Yeah, so the lakes all around the Rathdrum Prairie, Coeur d'Alene, Hayden, Spirit, Twin, all these lakes along the edge are there because when this gravel came out of the Pendray Basin and was deposited down there, it blocked off all these drainages. So before the gravels were there, we would have had a large river channel with streams coming down to it, much like if you went into the mountains around here now, steep topography with, very small streams or rivers in the bottom of them. And so when we filled those up, we blocked off all those drainages and we formed all those lakes or dammed in behind there.
So the water flows downhill. So the water that's coming out of the Clark Fork and these other drainages into Lake Pendray, eventually some of it's going out of the Pendray River, but some of it is just going underground and flowing?
Yes. So the gravels are down near Bayview, and that is the general flow direction. That those gravels are somewhat leaking into the aquifer, and so it's very important to understand that. We also have drain. Anything that comes down is going to drain down these old streams and go into those lakes, and then those lakes eventually start feeding the aquifer. If you go to Rathdrum, they have a creek that in the spring is running really fast, and it goes about 100 yards out of town, and it's gone. It just goes right into the aquifer.
It's not only underground rivers feeding the Rathdrum aquifer. It's probably like a big lake underneath there, mm-hmm. enough to supply water to a population like Spokane that's growing. Is there any concern of that water source ending or, you know, becoming less available?
I guess the only way that we'd get less is if we, you know, go into drier times where we have less precipitation, because we have a huge catchment basin and it all goes down to that aquifer. So it's good in the sense that we have every bit of rain that hits the prairie just about goes down in, but alternatively, we could pollute that aquifer pretty easily. So people that might decide to dump something out on the prairie, or we have a train leak or something, that stuff goes right down just like the rainwater and the snow melt and everything else. So it is vulnerable, and it's a good source, but pollutants can get down there just as easily.
So if something is to spill into the lake, it's not just the lake that is taking the hit. It eventually will go into the aquifer.
Right.
How important is it to protect this water source for a metropolis such as Spokane, with possibly regulations or environmental protection acts, something like that?
Well, obviously, this is a very fragile environment, and the fact that it is a surface aquifer means that everything that's on the surface, that any porous ground, that whatever you put there is going to eventually get into this aquifer and eventually come out. And as people are pumping the water out of this aquifer for industrial purposes, agricultural purposes, for domestic uses, the people in Spokane are probably more at risk than we are. But if Spokane goes, so does Sandpoint. I mean, we're very lucky to have this aquifer here. Without this aquifer, you know, we wouldn't have this large population and that supports this little gem of a place that we call Sandpoint. You know, recreation is very important. Tourism is very important.
So the economic impact of water is
severe. It's severe.
Can I ask one more? What do you think about the phrase, dilution is the solution to pollution?
It doesn't work.
Okay.
Another question on protecting this source of water that feeds so many. Do we know what kind of regulations they have in place now to protect it, or are there any?
Oh, you'd probably be going beyond our expertise, but I know the Department of Environmental Quality and other people, they do monitor that. You know, there's a train refueling station out on the prairie, and they have multiple layers of barriers and things to keep, if they do have a leak, that to keep that going. But it's a huge area that's exposed, and you know, anywhere along there you could easily contaminate it.
There is also a really wonderful publication on the Rathdrum Spokane aquifer that's this wonderfully prepared atlas of all these maps showing depth and showing the lakes and all kinds of basic information about the aquifer. So obviously somebody thinks it's very important, because this is a well-done document.
Do you have a source for that document?
You know, at home I do.
Okay. Well, we'll try to find out what that is.
Yes, okay.
And speaking of maps, you showed us a map that you wanted to tell our audience about.
Yeah, so Roy and I, for many years that I worked with him, started as a poster. We threw together all of his work just to see what it looked like. And then we got most of it done. And so it became a goal of his to get this map out. And so I'm the computer side of things. So we put together this geologic map showing the different glacial deposits of all of Northern Idaho, essentially a collection of all Roy's work. And we're in the process of printing that. And so those should be available in the next few months, we hope.
And I'm sure they'll be available from the Ice Age Flood Institute. And that's kind of what we've been talking about, this phenomena that happened 15,000 years ago that created everything we know in our lives today, including all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Tell us a little bit briefly about the Ice Age Floods Institute.
Well, thanks for bringing that up. This is why we're here. We are both members of the Ice Age Flood Institute and actually officers in the chapter here. The Cours du Deluge is the name of the chapter, which tells the significance of this area to the floods, Cours du Deluge, the heart of the floods. We're one of 11 chapters in four different states and probably 500 members. And it's a nonprofit, educational nonprofit organization that was started in 1995. And it has been responsible for the passage of a bill to designate a National Ice Age Flood Geologic Trail. And that was passed in 2009, but was not funded. But at least it's passed, and we're looking forward to this development of this trail that the National Park Service will do. And I want to tell people there is no land grab going on with this. There's no new land that's going to be lost. So that was an issue, I know, with some people.
Ice Age Floods Institute, and I'm sure people can Google that. It's IAFI.org. You can go there. It's a really nice website with great information. We want to thank you again, both Dean Garwood and Dr. Tony Lewis.
Just Tony.
Well, you're the president of the Ice Age Institute, by the way, and vice president.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today and sharing your expertise and insights of the story of the Ice Age Lake Missoula and the big floods.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And we are back live in the KRFY studios, and we now have a picture of the origins of this big, beautiful lake here in North Idaho and its influence on surrounding aquifers and other water sources. And this is the morning show special, Water is Life.
Now let's take a look at the water cycle and how water how that cycle influences water supply here and around the world. Joining us is Robin Fox, weather forecaster for the National Weather Service in Spokane.
Good morning, Robin, and thank you for joining us today to help us learn more about water and weather and the water cycle.
Well, thank you for inviting me to your program.
Let's start by, can you tell us a little bit about your job at the National Weather Service?
Sure. Well, I am a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Spokane. My job entails me to forecast the weather for eastern Washington and north Idaho, and I also monitor the weather for severe and hazardous weather conditions and issue the warnings for weather and water warnings that can affect life and property in the region.
So this is our second show in our series, Water is Life. We heard in our last interview about the origins of Lake Ponderay and how the water got there in the first place. Can you tell us more about how water is replenished by describing the water cycle?
Sure. One thing to keep in mind is water is always moving. And the water cycle is the process of this, of water moving above, below, and on the Earth's surface. So water from Lake Ponderay and the streams and rivers that feed it, some of that moisture will rise up into the atmosphere and turn into water vapor, and that is the evaporation part. And as that water gets heavier in the atmosphere and the atmosphere cools, it condenses into the clouds. So that's the condensation. When the moisture increases in the clouds by lifting or cooling in the atmosphere, that will cause the precipitation, the rain and the snow to fall out, which then goes back down to the surface and flows into the lakes and rivers in the region. So it forms the cycle.
And it goes on and on and on.
So you mentioned precipitation in that cycle. Do we have a sense of what the precipitation per year is in Bonner County? And what are record highs and lows?
Actually, we do have two sites in Bonner County that that keep records. There's one right in Sandpoint that's been keeping records since 1910. And then we have a site at Priest River that's been keeping records a little longer, since 1898. So from these records, we can determine what the average, the normal is for many types of weather information. So for precipitation, so the rain part of the precipitation, normally we see right around 33, 34 inches of rain per year across the county. The most rain that we've seen happened back in 1996 to 1997, where we saw over 48 inches of rain that year. And when we look at precipitation, we don't want to really follow the calendar year. For water, we like to look at the water year. And that starts October 1st and goes through September 30th. So that will cover the winter season as we're looking at precipitation. So that's why I mentioned the year 96 to 97 being a very wet year. On average, right now, our precipitation amounts are running really close to normal. The least amount of precipitation that we've seen has varied, and looks like we may have to go back to the 1800s. 1897 to 98 looks like it was a very dry year, and at Priest River, they had not even 12 inches of rain for the year. So that is quite a range that we have seen for precipitation. Taking a look at snow amounts, I'm sure you want to know more about that. That ranges quite a bit depending on elevation and where you are in the county. Comparing Sandpoint to Priest River, that range can be from 66 inches a year to 77 inches a year. And it does correspond that the most snow that we saw was, again, that year, 1996 to 1997, where we saw a range of 150 inches to 174 inches for that year for snow.
I'm sure the skiers were happy. And when you're talking about the lows, it seems like the last few years we've had less during the our summer out times, but have we had more during the winter times to kind of equalize that and get an average? So the last couple of years, do we have an average?
This current year, we are running very close to normal for precipitation, so that liquid part of the 33 to 34 inches. And what we have been seeing the last few winters, we've been seeing a lot of rain and snow over the wintertime and then the long, wet springs that have been going on. And then it seems like by the end of spring, then things just shut off and then we just dry out through the summertime. So it seems like we do get our moisture and it seems to be more packed in during our winter and spring seasons throughout the years.
From what I've been reading about wildfire, that's maybe one of the contributing factors to our bad wildfire events recently, is that you get all that vegetation growing in the spring and then everything just dries out.
Correct. And that's what we've been seeing the past couple years, is we've received all that rainfall, all that snow melt, and we've seen a lot of grass and brush that are growing very, very, very well. And then when the rain shuts off and we warm up so much, things dry out rather quickly. So we've seen that this year and last year as well.
Well, I'm sure I'm going to go back and listen to this again. It's fascinating and it's hard to take it all in. If you're ready to move on to our next question, what's the difference between weather and climate?
Oh, that is a good question. And sometimes they get confused a bit. Weather is actually the day-to-day changes in the atmosphere. So the changes in temperature, the wind, precipitation, cloud cover, and we know how much that can change from day to day across the inland Northwest. The climate is actually the average of the weather conditions over a period of time. So we look at a climate of the month. So we look at what the temperatures were for an entire month and compute the average, and that would be the average temperature for the month. we can compute the averages for a year, for a decade, and that all goes into the climate for an area.
Can we use weather data to help predict future climate?
Well, weather data does go into helping to determine a climate for an area. So we can look at a climate for the area and compute it over different segments of time and see what the trends are. And we can do that by looking at average precipitation and temperatures and try to find some patterns.
What patterns are you finding?
We are finding that over the last 50 or 60 years that there has been a slight warming trend that we've seen, especially in the overnight temperatures. We've seen that going on. We've also seen with precipitation maybe a gradual shift of precipitation that we see more intense precipitation and happening in that winter and spring season and not so much happening over the summertime.
And how sure are you of these predictions? I assume that there's a lot of statistics used in this.
Oh, yes. There is always some uncertainty with any type of prediction, especially as you go and predict things further into the future. But these were just some trends that we have been seeing and things that we'll probably continue to keep data on in the future.
And the more data that you have in the longer period of time than the predictions, you could be more certain of them?
We could also find other influences that may affect that as well. So that is something that more research needs to be done.
I know there's these trends in the general weather patterns, El Niño, El Niño. What do we see coming up in the next year, say? Do you have that statistics? Do you have that prediction yet?
Yes, we do. We do. So El Niño has to do with an atmospheric ocean phenomenon that happens in the Pacific Ocean. And that's where we see warming that happens in the ocean on the eastern side of the Pacific Basin, so off the coast of South America. And then on the other side by Indonesia, we see more cooling. When that happens, that affects the jet stream. And over time, affects what type of weather patterns that we get to our area. So with an El Niño pattern, we see that warming going on off of South America, and it will strengthen the jet stream that comes across over the southern United States. So over the winter season, we will tend to get more storm systems that will be across the southern U.S., while across the northern U.S., we won't see as much activity. What it also tends to do for our area is make temperatures a little bit milder. That is something that we have been calculating over the years and also seeing how much precipitation that we see, which also tends to be a little less than normal. The opposite is La Niña, and that's where we see more cooling that takes place off of the coast of South America. That tends to bring a stronger jet stream that affects more of Canada into the northern United States. And we've seen that pattern the last two winters, which brought us above normal precipitation and a lot of mountain snow.
So one is La Niña and the other one is El Niño.
Correct. Okay. Yes. So for this coming winter, it's forecast to be an El Niño winter, which means we should see more activity for the southern United States, less activity for our area. We could see a better chance of milder winter temperatures and below normal precipitation.
So the skiers might not like this.
The skiers may not.
And I've also been reading, again, with my reading about fire, that this all fits together because with milder winters, there's sometimes the bugs don't get killed off. And then the trees, that has led to more of the bug kill in the trees.
I've heard that too. We do need those colder temperatures to help our vegetation and our forests, definitely.
And so your end is the weather end, and then we need to find an entomologist to talk to, I guess.
To kind of cover everything.
It's complicated. So just to get back, you had said that we are seeing some trends in temperature and precipitation changes, either in, and some of it's just the pattern throughout the mm-hmm. year.
Correct.
Are there other ways that this might, that those changes might impact us?
Well, one thing that we'll probably be seeing with the milder temperatures is the snow in the mountains may start coming off quicker than normal. So experiencing more of a mountain snowpack melt happening sooner. Right now, our peak time tends to be around May. If we had that happening earlier, that could affect some of the vegetation that would be losing some of that moisture. It also prolongs the amount, the lack of precipitation that we would get during the summertime. If we lose our snowmelt and our water coming from the mountains sooner, that may impact how things go through our summer.
It all goes together, it sounds like. What is a rain on snow event, and what are the impacts of a rain on snow event?
Oh, good question. Rain on snow event happens in the wintertime, and we see this a couple times each year. It's after we get a good snowstorm. Everything with our fresh snow is covered with white, and we have a few inches on the ground. And then we will get another storm system coming in that has warmer temperatures. And as it moves into the region, our temperatures are start warming above freezing, and we get the precipitation falling as rain on top of our snowpack that we have. When that happens, it can lead to multiple things, including where does the rain go? It will soak into the snow, but if we get too much of it, it may lead to ponding in low-lying areas and some flooding issues, and then it'll cause us to lose some of our snowpack and wash away. Sometimes after one of these systems pulls through, we'll get the cooling air behind it, causing our temperatures to fall back below freezing again. And then all of that rain-soaked snow will then turn to ice, and we get ice on the roadways and everywhere. So there's a few impacts that happen with that.
Yes, a very familiar pattern in North Idaho. I imagine it because of more flooding, too, there's more erosion and the impacts of any time that there's too much water to be contained.
Right. Too much water at any time is not good. We just need it gradual increases and decreases.
And you mentioned floods and the repercussions of flooding. Can you go into that just a little bit more?
The repercussions of flooding? Well, as I was mentioning, the peak time for flooding tends to be in the mid to late spring as that mountain snowpack is melting off. We see it picking up in the April into May time frame. What I like to allude to is we like to see our spring temperatures gradually warm because we want that snowpack to come off slowly and flow into the rivers and streams to alleviate any types of flooding. Anytime that we get those gradual warm spells that happen in the springtime, that just trigger that mountain snow to melt off rather quickly and then run down feed those streams and rivers, and then we see our flood levels going up. So that's one of the impacts. And we saw that this last spring as we got so warm in the spring. Now, people in the valleys were probably enjoying that, but those near the rivers and the streams were feeling the effects of the higher water levels with that.
So it's not only dangerous to humans, it also erodes. Erosion, you alluded to erosion also.
Yes, it can lead to erosion, especially in areas that have experienced wildfires recently. What happens when we get very hot fires that burn in our forest lands? What it'll tend to do is bake the ground. It runs so hot that precipitation, when it does fall, can't soak in. So it's going to run down the slopes and down into the valleys. And that can lead to erosion. It can lead to slides of debris flows, mudslides that will slide down into the valley areas. Another big impact with that.
There is a lot to this weather. This is really fascinating, Robin, and I want to continue, but we have our final question for wrap up here.
Okay. Right.
Does the National Weather Service use weather observations from citizens?
Yes, we do. We have many sources that we use, observations from citizens, people that have their own weather stations that they're running from their homes and hooked up to the internet. You're able to share that data on the internet, and us at the National Weather Service are able to access that data, which is terrific because it gives us more information to look at. We also have observers that have their own rain gauge that report the rainfall and report it online, and we're able to use that data, which is terrific, especially when we see times with lots of snow and rain, and we can look at totals for the day, which is wonderful to use. We also have volunteers that are weather spotters that are happy to give us a call or willing for us to call them when there is severe or hazardous weather going on, and we can get more information, more ground truth when we get storms rolling in. And if anybody on your listening area wants to partake in any of these programs, they're willing to give us a call and contact us or email us, and we could get them set up with that.
That's great, and we will pass that information on. So thank you, Robin, for the interview.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, great interview, and thank you for your professional work that helps us all understand our world and our water.
Well, thank you very much.
We're back live in the studio, and we just interviewed Robin Fox, a meteorologist from the National Weather Service. So join us again next Wednesday, September 12th, for the third part of this four-part series on water. Water is life.
Week 3 takes a look at the many uses of water, residential and recreational, in agriculture and industry, and the regulations that makes it possible to use the water responsibly to assure good stewardship and protection. We will be talking with Molly McCann from the Lakes Commission and Doug Jones from the Idaho Department of Water Rights. And this is 88.5 KRFY.